From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In this gourmet era, canned food doesn't get much respect, but that humble tin of chicken soup in the pantry has a fascinating backstory. Canning was invented to feed soldiers during the French Revolutionary Wars, and the commercial canning industry that followed was, at first, a dicey business.
Swells and springers were the common names referring to cans that would bloat from putrefaction from bacteria, and you'd open a can and it would be spoiled.
Historian Anna Zeta talks about her new book, Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. Botulism, BPA, and the origins of commerce in processed food. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. We live in an age of prepackaged food. Most of the food we eat is produced by just 20 companies. Frozen, powdered, condensed, and individually wrapped industrial concoctions are now staples in most American diets. How did we get here? A new book argues it all began with a seemingly humble innovation, canned food. Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry, traces the long history of commercial canning, from its origins in the French Revolutionary Wars to the present day. Along the way, we learn how the canning industry fought again and again to gain the confidence of consumers. Ultimately, it won, and it shaped our behavior. Despite a long history of health scares, episodes of lead poisoning, botulism, mercury contamination, many of us think nothing of piling our shopping carts high with prepackaged foods. How did the packaged food industry become so powerful? Should we be so trusting? Historian Anna Zeta is here to tell us. She's an assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University, and she joins me from the studios of KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Anna, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
You write that, quote, "The tin can and the sometimes mushy food inside deserve our full and rapt attention," end quote. Why?
One of the things that sort of drew me to the project initially was that I had the sense that there are so many everyday products that we interact with frequently and yet don't spend much time thinking about how they have come to be part of our everyday or why they matter. And so the canned food is such a product. It's such a, as you said, humble and sort of easy to ignore thing. And yet, as I started to dig deeper into the history of the canning industry, the canning process, the can itself, it made clear that it opened up so many different avenues of interesting understandings of our current food system, of technology, of gender, of the environment, of how we interact and trust business and corporate influence in our lives. So many of the methods pioneered by the canners in the early days of the industry laid the foundation for what we know of as a broader American food industry today.
Back up for me. How did you first become interested in the history of commercial canning?
I've always been very interested in the history of food. My PhD was in the history of science, medicine, and technology, having come from a kind of science background in college. And as I started to look into the history of food, I was really interested in sort of technologies in food, how they shaped the food system that we take for granted today, because I also have a lot of interest in sort of contemporary food activism and food justice movements around access to food. And I noticed these cans that were kind of everywhere, you know, staples of food pantries and canned food drives and discussions around how we think about our food system. And I started looking into the history of this. At the same time, I was also really interested in questions around people's relationship to food through the environment and recognizing historically that one of the biggest changes in our relationship to food and the environment came from an ability to no longer be bound by seasons or weather in the same way that people, you know, even 100 years ago were, and how food preservation had always been a necessary problem to overcome to, say, eat anything in Wisconsin in the winter, for example. And so canning became kind of the first food preservation technology that became industrialized. Then, as I continued to study canned food, another thing that emerged that really made it interesting to me was the National Canners Association, which began the major trade association of the canning industry in 1907. After a few name changes and consolidations, today became the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is today one of the major trade associations in the food industry. And as a result, one of the major sort of political and powerful players in our food system. So seeing that that Grocery Manufacturers Association began with the canning industry made me think that it could offer some real interesting insights about our contemporary food system.
You included in the book a poem by a World War II general that reads in part, "We can march without shoes, we can fight without guns, we can fly without wings to flap over the Huns, but how can our soldiers far over the seas make war on the Kaiser without their canned peas?"
Right.
War played a big part in the growth of the canning industry. Give us some examples.
Right, yeah. So as you mentioned in your introduction, the invention of canning was spurred by the French Revolutionary Wars. Napoleon, in the early 19th century, put out a call for a 12,000 franc prize for someone who could invent a better way to feed his soldiers on the move. And a French confectioner by the name of Nicolas Appert responded with the invention of canning. Then it was known as appertizing, which was basically taking food and sealing it in some kind of container. At the time, he used more ceramic crocks or glass, sealing it so that it was vacuum sealed and then heating it such that it was preserved through those methods. And this is before germ theory, before an awareness of how bacteria plays a role in this, but it was clear that doing this led food to last for much longer than it naturally would. And so he wins the prize, and that process then gets sort of picked up and brought overseas to the U.S. But it was that drive that Napoleon recognized one of the major limitations of being able to have a successful military campaign was being able to feed troops on the move when you're removed from agricultural lands and production and having to feed really efficiently a large number of people. But the industry as a sort of organized industry doesn't really take off until after the Civil War, because the Civil War gives this impetus to lots of different people, soldiers who've gathered from different parts of the country to try this food that's part of what they're being given to eat that they might have no motivation to buy otherwise. And after they sort of get a taste for some of these canned products, especially condensed milk, Borden's got a contract from the Union Army and is brought into the Union Army camps. And after they taste this, they go home and tell their wives and their mothers that this is a product worth trying. And that kind of helps move canned food from just being something that's supplied to these sort of unusual audiences like soldiers or explorers or settlers traveling west, and to move into the everyday home, the domestic economy. And then World War One and Two both have lots of effects in terms of the rising popularity of canned food, both because of an awareness that being able to process food efficiently, there's a lot of, you know, focus on victory gardens and having people grow and can their own foods, less at the industrial level than the, you know, in the home. But all of those things increase the familiarity and the willingness of consumers to trust canned food.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with historian Anna Zeta. She's author of a new book, Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. It explores the history of canned food and the influence the industry had on larger prepackaged food industry. Baltimore was at one point known as the mother of the canning industry. Why did canning take off here in particular?
I sort of joke that Nicolas Appert was referred to as the father of the canning industry, while Baltimore is the mother of the canning industry, so a funny union. But as canning came over from France and England to the United States, it found a really fertile home in Baltimore, in part because of an established local agricultural system there and because of the abundant oyster beds of the Chesapeake Bay. Oyster canning was one of the sort of first emergence of canning at a broader level. And also the fact that the city was growing in population, had workers who could staff the canneries, and that there were numerous rail connections coming into Baltimore so that you could produce and ship the canned goods out. And as a result, a lot of canners set up shop there, and then also the sort of organization of canners started to be housed there. The first association of canners, the Canned Good Exchange, was founded in Baltimore in 1882. And unfortunately, the archives of that first association were destroyed in the Great Fire of 1904 in Baltimore, and all of those records are gone, so we can't say too much more about it, but we know that that first Canned Good Exchange out of Baltimore actually sent the first petition to Congress to enact a pure food law in the 19th century, well before the actual Pure Food and Drug Act was passed in a couple decades later. And as a result, Baltimore really was the hub from which the canning industry later radiated as it moved into the Midwest and later the West Coast.
We're going to take a quick break here on The Record. When we come back, we'll talk about food safety and today's issues with Oklahoma State University historian Anna Zeta. Her new book is called Canned: The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. This is On The Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On The Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the history of canned food. My guest is Anna Zeta, author of Canned: The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. You've made some references to the efforts of the canning industry to win the trust of consumers. Were consumers initially suspicious of canned food?
Yes, they definitely were. I think the image of this opaque can that they couldn't see inside really differed from the way that 19th century consumers were used to buying their food, which was that they could go into the farm or into the market or into their own gardens and smell and, you know, move it around and see how it acted. And having that opaque wall between them and their products and the broader process that produced it really made a lot of consumers not so eager to try this new product.
What were they particularly worried about?
Well, I think at first they were just, this was something they didn't think that they needed, that it was something that was very different from the standard ways of producing food, which was much more local, much more focused on products that came from people they knew and trusted, whereas these came from unknown places and unknown hands. But also, the early industry had a lot of tangible problems to overcome. They were packing produce that was, you know, bred for fresh production, not for the can. So a lot of it got very mushy. It wasn't very tasty. They also had a lot of problems with spoilage. Swells and springers were the common names referring to cans that would bloat from putrefaction from bacteria. And you'd open a can and it would be spoiled. And that wouldn't really make consumers want to open another one.
And as you mentioned, food companies started selling canned products before we knew much about germs. So what resulted from that?
Yeah, so the canning industry continues to pride itself on having been very much pioneers in introducing science and the understandings of scientific findings into their processes. And it's true that they were very interested early on in some of the early findings about bacteriology and hired bacteriologists to come into the cannery to diagnose why they had so many of these spoiling cans. And then one of the big episodes I talk about is in 1919 and 1920, there was a big outbreak of botulism in ripe olives that had been canned in California. And the canning industry responded very strongly to this series of deaths that resulted and pretty much revolutionized their processing methods through funding a large scientific study of botulism and processes that could help control it, which continued to shape the industry into the present.
You point out that initially there was some debate about who was responsible for ensuring the safety of canned food, the consumer or the industry. That's hard to imagine now. How did that argument play out?
Yeah, so The canners in the botulism case in 1919-1920, even as they were launching these scientific studies and really trying to figure out what was going wrong, they also kind of wanted to deflect responsibility. And there's a lot of gendered language, too, in the way that they pointed to the housewife, the woman who was presumably opening the can and feeding it to her family and, you know, telling them that, well, any good housewife knows that how to spot, you know, spoiled food and to not feed it to her family. Use your nose was a constant refrain suggesting that if someone didn't have the skills to be able to detect the spoiled food, then it was sort of on them. And so it was a kind of two-pronged response in that they wanted to not claim the fault, but also recognize that there was something that could be done at the production side of things to minimize these deadly occurrences that really did mar their image and the reputation of the industry.
At first, canning companies welcomed government oversight. Why?
Right, yeah. And that's one of the things I think is most interesting in terms of lessons for today. The canners saw government regulation as an external stamp of approval. That is, if consumers knew that these canned goods had been regulated by the government, they didn't just have to trust individual canners, they could trust the broader regulatory process, which tended to carry more weight. And so the canners really welcomed the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906. They were very much among the central players in pushing that forward. After the botulism cases, they funded from canning funds a statewide inspection service in California that later spread to other states as well, that paid for state inspectors to come in and oversee the process. And were also involved in a couple of amendments to the Pure Food and Drug Act in the 1930s that specifically targeted canned food. And so they really wanted government regulation to convey the authority and expertise of trust.
That's Anna Zeta here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Zeta's new book, Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. You write that the canning industry helped create the much larger processed food industry. In what way?
Well, by the 1950s, you have this kind of confluence of different industries emerging. So during World War II, when steel was rationed, canned food was not as readily available. So frozen food emerged and kind of filled the niche. But on the backs of the canning industry, that is, the farms that had previously contracted with canners were now contracting with freezers. So those two industries were really in concert. And then as you have this larger emergence of packaged cake mixes and all these other kinds of foods that became such a staple of the 1950s and the golden age of processed food, they all started to use a lot of the methods, the relationships with farmers and with middlemen and jobbers and warehousers, all of these things that the canners had really figured out. And now these other food industries were starting to use their methods as well, such that by the end of the 1970s, the National Canners Association changed its name to the National Food Processors Association, and the trade journal that had been called The Canner for a long time was now called Processed Prepared Food. So you could see kind of at the mechanism and the level of a trade organization, they now met all together annually for an annual conference across all of these different food processors, and they recognized that the canners had pioneered methods that they could now all benefit from. So as a result, you know, into the present, the canning industry certainly has its own separate set of interests, but at the same time, the interests of theirs are tied up with broader awareness and acceptance of processed food in our lives.
You also argue in the book that this trajectory of canned food mirrors a larger trend in American culture toward lack of transparency.
Right, yeah. And so I like that the opacity of the can itself mirrors this broader opacity, emerging opacity of the way that we just have to trust so many, you know, black boxes in our lives, computer technologies, digital technologies that we don't really understand, but we put our trust into. And as with recent, you know, Facebook and Google proceedings, this concern about who are we trusting? What are these black boxes where we have to trust these other experts that what they're sending us is good? And that speaks to just an increasing complexity of technologies and knowledge in our world and how consumers increasingly have to, you know, get a PhD in something to understand really where their food comes from or where how technologies work to understand the broader system that we're all a part of.
Anna Zeta, one of the most chilling sections of the book is the part about the present day. You write about a plastic component called bisphenol A, BPA. It's an endocrine disruptor, something you probably shouldn't consume, but it's a common ingredient in the linings of food cans and can leach into the contents. There's been a lot of activism to try and change that, but you cite a study in which participants ate fresh, local, organic foods instead of canned, and their levels of BPA went up. How do you explain that?
Yeah, that study has really stayed with me. The researchers found, indeed, that the local food group had had higher levels of actually a different endocrine disruptor called DEHP, but it's very similar to BPA in their blood systems from those who are eating canned food. And after some research, they found that probably what happened was that the local dairy where they were getting their organic milk was using a kind of plastic tubing that would connect the cow's udder to the glass bottles. And just the warm milk passing through those plastic tubes would leach enough plastic components into the milk that the consumers were getting this high levels of endocrine disruptors. And one of the conclusions that I draw both from that study and from the book as a whole is that as much as we kind of might feel like we have control over what we're taking into our body, like we can decide as an individual to not eat so much canned food, or the canning industry, as it has been working to do, can remove BPA from its canned food linings. But doing that doesn't mean that we're able to ignore or get away from all of these challenges of our modern food system, because we're so enmeshed in the systems that feed us. And so that seems to me that the conclusion is that we must have much more rigorous regulation of all of these food contact substances, not just canned food or canned food linings, but everything we take in. An individual consumer can't know all of the places that these chemicals might come into our food, into our bodies. And so there has to be a broader systemic oversight.
Your book implies that the prepackaged food industry now puts more effort into managing the perception of a problem like BPA than the problem itself.
Right. And, you know, I think that this characterizes probably a lot of companies, and that something isn't much of a problem until consumers say that it is. And as with the BPA issue, there has been action on a number of company parts to move away from BPA in their linings. But some of the research suggests that behind the scenes, they say BPA isn't really a problem. But since these, you know, whiny consumers think it is, we'll change something. And that, I think that that attitude and that perception of kind of adversarial relationship between consumers and the companies that feed us doesn't yield the best outcomes. But I guess the hopeful note, perhaps, is that I think it does, it should remind consumers that their voice and their expression of concern does matter, that these companies do care a lot about what consumers think and say. So especially in moments of sort of industry vulnerability, when they're most apt to respond to consumer concern, it is important for consumers to express their desires.
Ana Zeta, do you eat canned food?
I do eat canned food. I think that it is a really valuable shortcut convenience. I think when you think about all the broader processed food, in some ways, you know, it requires less energy once you get it to your home than frozen foods, which you have to keep in the freezer. In terms of an uncertain energy future, there's real value in what cans can offer us. But I also consume them with a real awareness of what companies I'm supporting and try to research what they're doing in terms of supporting research into things like removing BPA from their linings, but also just how they're part of a broader food system that I think reinforces good values. And I try to can my own vegetables when I can too. I think it's really neat, even though that's not a reality for many people because of time or access, but being aware of the process and how complicated it is and how much labor we save when we buy processed food helps us to appreciate it when we do use it.
Well, thank you for telling us about the book. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Ana Zeta, an historian, is an assistant professor at Oklahoma State University. We've been discussing her new book, Canned: The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. We have a link to information about the book at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us on The Record. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.